listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Think, darling, think. There must be something really rotten we can do today.
I'm thinking.
That was the cartoon character Natasha Fatale, voiced by actor June Foray, followed by the character Boris Badenov, voiced by the actor Paul Frees. Boris and Natasha gained notoriety as figures in the cartoon program Rocky and Bullwinkle in the 1960s. Their role was, in essence, to endlessly cook up plots to make trouble for America.
Oh, just like you, darling. Always trying to help others get a little more pain out of life. I have it, darling. A contest. I like being evil because, in 25 words or less...
I like it.
That certainly sounds familiar to anyone who's been looking at U.S. media for the past 2 or 3 years. And we're going to discuss that with Professor Luciana Bone. We spoke with her via Skype from Pennsylvania on Wednesday. Well, Luciana, we had the spectacle that we discussed, I guess, some history for context last week of Trump going to Helsinki, shaking hands and sitting in a conference room alone with an interpreter with President Putin for an hour or two and saying
that,
and saying that tensions had been reduced, and then watching the Western press and the political establishment here go absolutely bananas because Trump didn't stand there and call Putin every kind of criminal and name and stuff and threaten him. That's where we're at now.
Well, the hysteria over Helsinki, the aftermath in the press here in the United States was just amazing. Calling Trump a traitor, a Russian agent, a disgraceful performance, that was McCain. He disowned his own intelligence agency. He even dared to say that there was no Russian collusion in the 2016 U.S. elections. But my favorite quotes are from Ann Applebaum, And she was speaking to NPR audiences, and she said, I don't think we mentioned this last time, Trump's appeasement of Putin is actually worse than Chamberlain's appeasement of Hitler.
And I know.
You want to comment on that?
No, I'm just, sitting here with
astonished.
My...
astonished.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, first of all... never mind. We're not going to go into the history of that, but of what really happened at Munich. But that was just astonishing. Appeasement of Putin. Did Trump give Czechoslovakia away to Putin?
No.
I don't know.
I know.
Yeah, and then, really correlating Putin with Hitler again. And then Brennan, who was the CIA director for Obama, said Donald Trump's press conference performance in Helsinki rises to and exceeds the threshold of high crimes and misdemeanors. It was nothing short of treasonous. Not only were Trump's comments imbecilic, he's wholly in the pocket of Putin. Republican patriots, where are you? He asks. But, I want to ask the question. If you asked the American public, an American who follows the mainstream media, what proof is there he or she provide or cite or allude to that Russia interfered in the 2016 presidential elections. So, the answer is nothing.
Well,
because
the answer
it's
is
classified.
The answer
yeah,
is
go ahead.
The answer is who is Ann Applebaum and what is her job? Because Ann Applebaum, she cut her teeth as a propagandist covering what was happening in Eastern Europe in the 1980s.
That's right.
She's been an editor at The Economist and The Spectator and the editorial board of The Washington Post from 2002 to 2006. But she runs at the London School of Economics, ARENA, which is a project on propaganda and disinformation. Disinformation is her job. And Russia is her specialty.
Yes, it is.
So this is why we hear from Ann Applebaum about these things.
That's right.
She says that the United States should not enable the existence of the Russian government. She shouldn't enable its existence. I don't know what that means. I mean, that's like a negative statement saying basically regime change.
Yeah.
She's. In other words, the short and simple answer, when you're talking about somebody that's talking about international relations between two nuclear-armed states, she's a lunatic.
Yeah. She's an employee of the propaganda agency. So, it's interesting to look over briefly, if we can, the sequence of the development of Russiagate.
Yes.
It's interesting how fast the Obama administration moved to, even before the inauguration, moved to begin to make things difficult for the new administration, for the Trump administration. So shortly after Election Day, Obama ordered the U.S. intelligence community, I love the way they call it, community,
yeah,
to issue a public report about the supposed Russian scheme. And that means 17 intelligence agencies, 11,000 employees, and now it's this thing grew from there. So I interpose here that later on, you can see how this story evolves and is amended as it evolves, because later on, Obama was asked, why didn't you do anything since you knew supposedly, and Brennan covers for him and said, well, we did. I mentioned it to my counterpoint in the Soviet intelligence services that they shouldn't interfere, but they didn't listen. This is the sort of thing that goes on, that the public is told. So then, very shortly after the December date, December whatever I said, okay. After on December 6th or 7th, 9th, sorry, on December 9th, Obama ordered a report. On January 6th, this interesting report was produced and released as a classified report to the public. And so the report said, on December 9th, 2016, President Barack Obama directed the intelligence community to conduct a full review and produce a comprehensive intelligence report assessing Russian activities and intentions in recent U.S. elections. We declassified for you, public, a version of this report consistent with our commitment to transparency and while still protecting classified sources and methods. So the intelligence community assesses that the type of system the Russian actors love, this language, the types of systems the Russian actors targeted or compromised were not involved in vote tallying. So that's right. One thing they say. Then they say the intelligence community concluded Russia's attack was aimed at helping Trump and hurting Clinton. And they also add, the report adds, the conclusions in the report are all reflected in the classified assessment. What you public are getting is the declassified report, which does not and cannot include the full supporting information, including specific intelligence and sources and methods. In other words, you are not entitled. You are not going to see any proof here because that's classified intelligence. So as a result of that, the United States imposed a slate of punitive measures against Moscow. In addition to imposing new sanctions, Washington expelled a number of Russian diplomats close to Russian diplomatic compounds in Maryland and New York, which was Russian property. So, and then again in May 2017, Brennan was talking to a law body, some lawmakers, and he was saying that Russia election meddling had been very aggressive. He said that he studied Russian intelligence activities over the years, and he knew how Russian intelligence services have been able to get people to betray their country. Because one of the problems with accusing Trump of treason directly, as Brennan does, and in a way Applebaum does, then others, like the head of Homeland Security, backed off and said, no, I mean, he probably didn't know what he was doing. Trump didn't know what he was doing. We're not saying he was active in this. So they contradict themselves, each other, etc. Now, we come to Mueller. So now it seems that Russiagate is managed by the special procurator or
special counsel.
What is
it
called?
Special counsel or whatever, yeah. Special prosecutor.
Mueller, Robert Mueller. And who wants to question the president. This is the background before Helsinki. And immediately the New York Times publishes the lists of questions that Mueller would like to pose to Trump. It's interesting that every move by Mueller is always announced by a barrage of media which are led by the New York Times. So if they are really scoops, then Mueller's office is full of holes.
Right.
If they are not scoops, but leaks, it's clear that Mueller and the media, especially the New York Times, are together in this. This is the same New York Times that had that awful woman that is now with the, what, Judith?
Yeah,
what was
Judith,
her name?
Judith Miller.
Who pushed, yeah, go ahead.
Judith Miller.
Judith Miller?
Yeah.
Who pushed the weapons of mass destruction and apologized in 2004, 2005. The New York Times apologized to its readers for lying.
Yeah,
for not looking. Yeah?
Sorry about all those dead people. My mistake. Yeah, she said that was her. She's like, sorry about all those dead people. My mistake.
Yeah, that's it. And now we're going to lie again. And so there seems to be a collusion between this Mueller and the whole establishment and the press. So, but it's also interesting to find out how empty the accusations of treason are, given that the evidence of Russia intervention is non-existent. So the 49 questions that Mueller wants to pose that the New York Times published are actually divided into four chapters. The resignation of Michael Flynn, the removal of James Comey, the relationship with Jeff Sessions, and the coordination of the electoral campaign with Russia. That's another topic.
Right.
Those are the four chapters. Michael Flynn, what did he do? So he had been national security advisor for about 20 days, and he's accused of having worked as a lobbyist for Turkey, of having been compensated by Russia Today for a speech he made in Moscow in 2015,
right,
without declaring,
right,
what he was paid, and to have spoken to the Russian ambassador in the United States in the period of transition between Obama's exit and the inauguration of Trump.
Right.
All right.
All normal things. These are normal things that people do every day.
Yeah.
Every day. Hi, I work with the incoming administration. One of the reasons we were elected is that we promised to increase, to improve relations between us and the other nuclear power that are dangerous at the moment. So
right,
I figured I'd have a
voted,
right,
no.
and it's why we got elected, partly why we got elected, and therefore I decided to have a conversation with their ambassador as we were coming in, saying, "Look, don't let anything these people do make you go crazy, because we're going to sit down and try and solve some of these problems when we get in." And for that...
So that's treason.
That's right. That's treason.
Okay. Then we have James Comey, the former director of the FBI, whom Clinton accused of losing her the elections over the Libya thingy-mabob, over her Libya debacle.
Right.
The murder of the ambassador. So he started an investigation on Trump and Russia, and after months, Trump removed him. And then Comey published a book and gave a whole series of interviews criticizing Trump and disseminating innuendos, but without producing a single proof of this famous Russiagate. Jeff Sessions.
Yeah.
What's his treason? Now, Jeff Sessions was accused of, this is amazing, was accused of having met the Russian ambassador at a concert.
On stage. They were standing on a podium somewhere, you know, as part of a panel. And he met him there. And when, you know, in passing. And I guess he was asked, have you ever met this guy? And he said, well, have you ever had a conversation with this guy? Whatever. He said, no. And apparently he did. He was like, oh, hi, nice to meet you. You know, that was the extent of their conversation in front of an audience and TV cameras and stuff, you know. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And so he was intimidated and he ducked out.
Yeah, he decided to recuse himself from handling
yeah.
the case.
Yeah. So the question is, oh, then at Helsinki, the President of the United States met with the President of Russia. They discussed things that are leaking out. We're not quite sure, but it's an attempt to improve relations, which all summits began that way until they culminated in the triumph of 1975, which, as you noted in the past interviews, was a triumph because it was détente.
Right.
It was the détente, nuclear détente. And right. It was arrived at through several summits, many of which were horsing around, you know, for the public and right. to relax the climate. And ended up in this magnificent decision to suspend the on the brink kind of situation.
Right. You know, it's interesting too. One of the things that I've been looking at historical parallels, you know, or analogies to some of the things that are happening now, and particular the use of the term treason. Back in 1964, there was a book published written by a guy, John A. Stormer, who was a John Bircher type, a hard right wing, I would have to say, and hopefully his estate won't sue me, maniac. the book was called, and it became a, it sold maybe a million copies or more among right-wing conspiracy theorists back at the time. None Dare Call It Treason. And then there was a follow-up to it called None Dare Call It Conspiracy. And the central thesis was that these sneaky, secretive commies are, you know, have infected all of our institutions, and everything that you see going on around you that looks like it's moving towards peace, social justice, economic justice, etc., are really these insidious commies waiting to seize power and ship you off to the gulag. And I found a copy, a PDF copy of the book. I have a copy of this here somewhere, maybe two copies of it, having, you know, studied this nonsense over the last 50 years on a number of occasions. And, you know, you have chapters like, Have We Gone Crazy? The Origin of World Communism, The Growth of World Communism. How Has It Happened? Subverting Our Religious Heritage. The Press, Radio, and TV. And that one's an interesting chapter, by the way. It says the newsmen of America must share with the U.S. Department of State responsibility for the fall of China, the butchering of Budapest, Castro's rise in Cuba, and the destruction of the anti-communist forces in Indonesia, Laos, Algeria, and the Congo. That's how it starts out, that the U.S. press was responsible for both Ben Bella and Mao Zedong, whom it terms each of them as communist dictators.
together with the State Department.
With the State Department. Now, this is Joe McCarthy on steroids, really, because he was talking about how many communists there were hidden in the State Department. Well, one of the things that they did here in this particular chapter is they really attacked President John F. Kennedy. Here, I'm going to cite, here's talking about Anthony Lewis in the New York Times, for example. This is how old he is. This is 1962. Mm-hmm. President Kennedy vigorously defended two State Department employees yesterday against a newspaper woman's charges that they were security risks. He rebuked the reporter, Mrs. Sarah McLendon, when she made the accusation at his press conference. He personally vouched for clearance of the two men and said he hoped they would continue to serve without detriment to their character by the question. And it quoted the president as saying he and Dean Rusk, who was at that time the Secretary of State, had personally examined the record of these people and found that they were suited for their assignments. And McClendon didn't say what laid behind her charges. The two men were security risks. Now, this is a problem for this guy, except it says, such reporting might be excused if Lewis was not aware of, Wieland is one of the guys, records during 15 years in the State Department, but that he had the information became obvious in the final paragraphs of his long article, which said, the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee had made public accusations against Wieland, contained in testimony before the committee by three former ambassadors in Latin America. And what they did was charge the guy with assisting the overthrow of Castro by saying, in essence, that Castro would be an improvement over Fulgencio Batista, who was the dictator at the time. So this, by offering an opinion, a guy who was not on the ground in Cuba when he offered it, is accused by these people of helping to place the communist dictator Fidel Castro in power. This book is 254 pages of that kind of stuff, and it is 54 years old. And when you read this, you might as well be reading today's New York Times looking at it.
Yeah, and the irony here is that at that time, the treasonous element in the American establishment were the liberals and the Democrats.
They were the ones that were being accused of that. And as a matter of fact, at the time, in the same way that Trump is challenging the intel agencies, John F. Kennedy challenged the intel agencies. He was the last president, to my knowledge, that did that. And as one meme that went past me said, Kennedy was quoted as saying, this is, satire, I need the CIA like I need a hole in my head.
Oh, my God. Yes.
That was the outcome of his attempt to do this.
CIA,
yeah, that's right.
You can't touch the CIA.
Yep.
Yeah. It's a reversal. It's just, so in the 1960s, the enemy was within, and in the 2018, the enemy is again within.
Right.
That's what the, how much they can convince the public, we will see in the 2018 midterm elections. But one explanation for this Russiagate that is a work in progress, it's a kind of, don't know, saga. They keep evolving it. But if you take into account that the Democratic Party establishment went to war against the administration immediately, was it because Trump is a fascist, because Trump is a racist, no. Was it because Trump colluded with Russia? They know very well that he didn't.
Right.
So they're not interested in the truth.
That's right.
So what is behind this scheme? In fact, I consider it another WMDs. I mean, another job on the American public.
Right.
I consider it treasonous because they are abusing with the media the public trust. But we all know this. But I think it was, this was necessary so that Trump could not, they could, so that any initiative on his part to reverse any aspect of the strategy of democracy export, an idea, a policy that was initiated by the elder Bush in 1989. Oh, now the Russians are gone and we can export democracy, by which he meant capitalism. Right. And by freedom and democracy, he meant the corporate freedom and democracy, the market freedom and democracy. Right. So in order to put spanners in any attempt such as announced in his during his candidate, you know, these speeches up to the when he was running for candidate, when he was being a candidate.
Right.
NATO, better improvement, better relation with Russia, no more coups.
Right.
This must have sounded like anathema to them. Whether he meant it or not is irrelevant.
Right. These words were never spoken by a major party political candidate since World War II, and actually, with very few exceptions, even by minor political party candidates. And where they were never given space in the media, let alone introduced into the actual debates between the candidates. And that was the most damaging thing that Trump did. So we're out of time for this week. We're going to have to pick it up. One of the things I want to do when we come back next week is go back to Ann Applebaum and look at her relationship with Peter Pomerantsev, who was a former Soviet citizen who was her associate, her partner in this little propaganda mill at the London School of Economics, who was one of the people who, on behalf of the United States, helped to steal the 1996 election for Boris Yeltsin. We're going to look at some of the people around that who are now working this game here in the U.S. I'd like to thank you, Luciana, for your time.
Thank you very much. Pleasure always.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. Western Europe has long been the birthplace of both the most dangerous and the most enlightened ideas. It almost burned the planet alive with the two world wars and came up with the European Union as a prevention strategy against the third. Is the Eurocentric way the only strategy of saving the world from a new disaster, or is it perhaps the surest way of bringing it about? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Kalypso Nikolaidis, director of the Center for International Studies at Oxford University. Professor Nikolaidis, it's an honor talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, I know that for much of your academic career, you've been focusing on how people collectively negotiate their differences, and you see the European Union pretty much within that framework, not only as an experiment in governance, but also an experiment in settling and negotiating differences among the peoples. As we are recording this conversation, Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the European Commission and the quintessential European bureaucrat, is supposed to be meeting with Donald Trump, in many ways a remarkable American leader. How do you think the two are likely to proceed?
Well, I think we can all agree that it's not going to be an easy conversation, will it? Indeed, Juncker goes to Washington in the name of still 28 countries. The UK is still part of this story. And he is bringing with him on content a message of multilateralism, the idea that we are still a world governed by rules and institutions, that, well, the U.S. may have some issues with trade deficits, with the EU in general, with Germany in particular, say about their car exports. But that all of this can be discussed in a kind of civilized way in the context of, you know, bilateral dispute resolution, or in the context of multilateral discussions in the WTO. And shouldn't we do this? And of course, he's going to face a president, which I don't need to tell you, doesn't really agree with this way of doing things. And where coming to all this with a belief that institutions are not just kind of ineffective, but they're very often bad for what he calls America first. So how are those two going to talk to one another? What do we think?
Well, I think this is actually a very interesting question to ponder, because, as you said, these two represent two very different archetypes of governance. The neo-European way, which is based on lots of very small deliberations, slow motion decision making, and the what I would call the old American way, you know, get it done and get it done very quickly. And it's not that Donald Trump doesn't respect institutions. I'm not sure about that, but I think he definitely has a certain disregard for the dialogue for the sake of dialogue. I think he may believe that the European Union is using it to its advantage to keep the benefits. As much as you may dislike him, I'm sure that that is the case for most European intellectuals. Do you think Europe can learn anything from Donald Trump?
Well, first of all, I don't think international politics is about liking or not liking. It's about asking whether parties, countries and their leaders, or groups inside countries, have learned and know how to pursue their interests, which is what it's all about, in a way that's enlightened for them, meaning that it's in a way which also considers interest in the long run. Indeed, that's what the U.S. did. When you talk about the old American way, the old American way, depends what you call old, but has to do also with the end of World War II, where the U.S. created the Bretton Woods Institution and very much as a benign hegemon sometimes sacrificed its interest in the short run to pursue its interest and more general global interest in the longer run. So in this sense, I would say that the question for me is whether Trump is pursuing even his own country's interests in the appropriate way. It's not about whether I like him or not, whether I'd like him to babysit my children. That's not the point. And indeed, I don't think Donald Trump, you say, well, it's not necessarily that he dislikes institution. You witnessed as well as I did his coming to the UK and advising Theresa May, our prime minister, to sue the European Union. Indeed, he said many times he doesn't think the EU should continue to exist. He doesn't like WTO.
It really depends on the point of view, because you can make an argument that he actually trusts the institution of courts and he believes that judges will be able to make the best judgment. I mean, coming from Russia, you know, where people mostly distrust our court system, that is actually, you know, kind of, you know, a sign of respect. But nevertheless, you mentioned his slogan, America First. And I think in order to discuss it in a serious detail, we really have to contend the issue of nationalism. And what strikes me about nationalism is that for many in Europe, it is quite clearly a pejorative term. And we all understand why it is a pejorative term. But for many, you know, in other parts of the world, in the United States, even more so in Russia, it is actually a positive term. Do you think people in Europe and the leadership in Europe actually understand that not everybody shares their conception of nationalism and their fears of what it represents?
First of all, I mean, you're absolutely right, as you remarked about Russia, that it's not because we value institutions and conversations and peaceful resolution of disputes that I would be arguing that institutions always do the right thing. I mean, institutions are led by very valuable people, men, most of the time. If women were in charge, don't you think it would go better? And, you know, so institutions can have failed ideologies, they can be problematic. And indeed, the problem that Russians are struggling with, and Americans and many around the world, is a fear that people have that institutions, supranational institutions, is taking away what they value, their sense of place, control, as we say in the country where I live. That's why Brexit is also all about taking back control. Mm-hmm. And so if you're suggesting to me that it's a very universal trait to want to take back control, to feel that your life, that you are part of a polity, a politics that is closer to you and not somewhere out there, I'm with you. I agree. And maybe you and I could have a whole conversation about semantics. Mm-hmm. So we could say, well, yes, but nationalism is you often use as a term to denote the pathological or problematic aspect of national identity. To have a national identity, to be proud of it, to want to build democracy and solidarity within a space that's not global is a good thing. I agree with you. The question that you and I have to ask, we have to ask it to the Russians, we have to ask it to the Europeans, we have to ask it everywhere in the world, is when is it that people start turning this pride in who they are in their collective into a tool of exclusion, into a tool of aggressive intervention in other people's affair, indeed into a tool where you don't respect the national identity of the other side? So it's a very complex story, and you're absolutely right to imply that the European Union right now is struggling in trying to balance its people's yearning for this sense of control and the sense that we need to do things together in this crazy, dangerous world of ours. Mm-hmm. So it's a balance. And when you ask me about European elites, you know, there's every kind of political elites. There are those that are very blindly supranationalist, wanting to forget all about national identity. There are those who are very nationalist and populist. There are those in between. There are all sorts of shades of colors in Europe, as in Russia and as in everywhere.
Well, yes and no, because I think the main difference in how the European Union and Russia, for example, approach the issue of nationalism. For many in Europe, nationalism is almost the root of all evils. They certainly blame aggressive nationalism for the carnage of the World War II. And what they kind of miss is that for the country like Russia, nationalism was the saving grace. This is what carried us through those terrible years back in the late 30s and early 40s. This is what sustained us as a country. So for us, nationalism is not something that ruined half of the continent. It's something that allowed us to actually persevere in the face of that aggressive force. And what I wanted to ask you, and I think when I listen to Trump, at least, I think what he's trying to articulate in the best way he can is, something about that kind of nationalism, sustaining nationalism, rather than nationalism that seeks to destroy everybody else. Don't you think that when people in Europe are so frightened by either Putin, Trump, or people of that sort, don't you think that they are actually not so much fearing the danger that those personalities represent as much as the fear that sides within Europe, the fear of Europe itself?
Clearly, you're absolutely right to say that troubles or rather challenges always start at home. So stop pointing to the other. Look in your own backyard to see what your challenges are. And indeed, in our European backyard, I'm not sure I agree with you when you imply that, you know, when Europeans are looking at Russia, they kind of forget what we owe as Europeans to what you call Russia, Russian nationalism. And I'd rather call, you know, Russian courage, Russian pride.
I would call it patriotism, but it's ultimately based on the very strong national feeling.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, we all, you and me and others, want to use the term patriotism to say that's the positive, the fighting for the right cause, you know, dimension of nationalism. So you, like me, and I think many people in Russia, will make this distinction between the kind of national attachment that leads you to defend values, to defend values against Nazism, to defend values against all sorts of problems in the world, also to be solidaire with one another, to help one another. I mean, all of these elements of patriotism and national identity are very important. The question is, when you want to give a lot of support to Trump, I see where you're coming from. You're saying, in a way, you know, the Americans and us in Russia, we share this understanding. We're not like these naive kind of Europeans who want to forget about nation. We understand that making our country great again is, you know, the best thing in the world. And you can say that, but are you sure that you want to share with Putin the idea, with Trump, the idea that this requires, therefore, to build walls, to put children in away from their parents, to whip up, you know, racial politics, to do all sorts of things, which I'm not sure as Russians you really do want to share with a Trump.
I have never actually bought the idea that we as Russians can really say anything to the Americans to the extent that they will actually, you know, take that as our advice. I'm not a big fan of, you know, meddling in interference stories simply because I don't believe it's possible. But I think it's also a little bit manipulative to kind of lump all those things together, because you can criticize any politician or any head of state on one set of policies and agree with him on another. Why do we have to sort of criticize or praise Trump in such a wholesale manner?
Oh, and I don't. So you and I can completely agree with this. Let me give you one example. NATO. You know, Trump's, and I'm not sure speaking to me from Moscow is the best example you would take, but, you know, Trump comes to Europe and say, hey, guys, you know, why are only four countries in NATO spending 2% of their GDP or more on defense? We are bearing too much of the burden. Now, of course, we could say, well, that serves you. It's the industrial military complex. We could say that the Germans, for instance, spend a lot of money, you know, in development, and that's conflict prevention. It's a kind of security. You could say all sorts of that, all sorts of things like this. But you could also say that in a security alliance, there should be an equal sharing of the burden. So in that sense, I don't like the style, the way Trump says it. But on substance, it may not be such a bad idea. Now, of course, from the Russian viewpoint, I'm not sure that's the example that you prefer. But on this one, I'm happy to say that there should be a conversation with Trump.
Well, Professor Nikolaidis, I really want to have that conversation with you, but in a couple of minutes. We have to take a very short break now, but we will be back shortly. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Kalypso Nikolaidis, director of the Center for International Studies at Oxford University. Professor Nikolaidis, just before the break, we touched upon the NATO issue, and this is a very, very sensitive issue for Russia. I know that many officials in Moscow find it very hard to distinguish between the European Union, which is a political and economic entity that Russia is eager to develop its relationship with, and NATO, which Russia sees as occasionally aggressive military alliance. Do you think it even makes sense for Russia, or for that matter, for the Europeans, to try to distinguish between these two entities?
Well, of course it does make sense. As you just explained very brilliantly, there are two very different entities. And indeed, the EU is a peaceful entity and only a defensive entity. And of course, NATO is also a defensive organization, but it's one that includes other countries than the EU. But, you know, on the other hand, I would say that since you are raising the issue of NATO, that while I think that Russia has complex relationships with NATO and with the EU, it's fair enough for Russia to express, you know, its own interest vis-a-vis the kind of alliances that happen among its neighbors.
But I wonder, how would you navigate those very difficult relationships? Because on the one hand, as I said, Russia wants to have, you know, better trade ties with the European countries. But when those countries are kind of, from the Kremlin perspective, lured into the NATO alliance, that makes it very difficult to deal on the diplomatic level. And I'm sure you've heard we've had a number of scandals recently. The Russian diplomats have been expelled from Greece over the major controversy surrounding the supposed Russia's interference in the domestic politics of Greece, dealing with the with its long-running dispute over Macedonia. What is a fair game in when it comes to Europe? I mean, because as I said before, there's trade, there's diplomatic relationship, and then there's another aspect to it, which is security relationship.
Well, it is a complex question indeed. And you raise, of course, the latest example of the Macedonian question. And indeed, I'm not here to say whether the expulsions were grounded on what kind of information. You know, I'm just an academic. Mm-hmm. I don't have inside information. But what we do know is that you know, a Russian businessman or did support, pay, whatever, people who belong to the extremes, you know, on both sides, in Greece and in North Macedonia. People who have rejected an agreement that we have taken, the Prespa agreement between the two countries, we've taken 25 years to get where we are. It's an amazing agreement. It's a very modern agreement. It's an agreement of deep reconciliation between two countries, of course, over the name that becomes North Macedonia, over the sharing of identity between two countries, but also lots of other elements of cooperation. And so when you say, well, you use the word lure country into NATO in asking me about this. And I would say very strongly, knowing all my friends in Skopje in North Macedonia, that they wouldn't, all of those who signed the agreement under Prime Minister Zaev would not consider that they have been lured. They would consider that indeed this agreement, this is the great price or the great reward for their country to both enter NATO and to start negotiations with the European Union.
Let's be fair here, because I think it's clear from the public opinion polls in Macedonia that the public is quite divided on this issue. And we had previous examples in other Balkan countries of people sort of being, I wouldn't say pressured or lured, as the term I used before, but kind of prodded towards that military alliance. And that obviously comes on the back of many other far more fraught issues. One of them is the issue of Ukraine. Another one is the issue of Georgia. The third one, a major one, was an issue of NATO interference and regime change in Libya, which absolutely appalled not only Russia, but I think ultimately led to the major immigration crisis in Europe. So, you know, this is definitely, again, this is a formal structure, and people who belong to NATO, they talk about the peaceful nature of that alliance. But when push comes to shove, this alliance does act very opportunistically. And sometimes I think Russia would argue it acts against the best interests of humanity, as was the case in Libya. So is it really such a surprise that Russia would feel so apprehensive about this alliance moving ever closer to its borders?
Well, I understand that is a question that is very important in Russia, one can hear that. But in your question, you've raised so many different issues that it's very hard to respond with a general question. So if you're asking me whether the intervention of NATO in Libya was a great success, I'm with you. Not really. I mean, maybe in the very short term, to avoid many deaths in Benghazi, it wasn't a bad idea, but it was very mismanaged, and we have a bit of a mess in Libya right now. And indeed, you're completely right that this has contributed to the so-called refugee crisis. That's a different issue from NATO in the eastern neighborhood, or rather what I would call the shared and disputed and contested neighborhood between Russia on one hand and the European Union on the other. And within that, again, Aksana, I ask you, shouldn't we distinguish between the former Soviet space, the Georgias and Ukraine of this world, where, yes, we could have a whole conversation about who wanted NATO and that Ukraine itself was divided and all of that, we can have that conversation. That's, again, different from Southeast Europe, from the Balkans, who were never a Soviet space, which historically, even under Tito, were always in between, which, of course, since the end of the Cold War, have themselves expressed in many different ways their wanting to be part of the European Union, and which, of course, themselves are complicated. When you're Serbia, it's not Serbia or Bosnia are not the same story as Albania, Montenegro, or indeed North Macedonia. So we would need to have a complex conversation.
I certainly do not believe in the spheres of influence. I believe in each country's right to self-determination. But I think that concept is being abused way too often. And one thing that unites all those profiles, all those cases that I mentioned before for Russia, is the mode of decision making. Because if you go back to Libya and if you actually analyze how the decision to overstep the UN mandate was made, it was made because of two individuals. It was made because of Nicolas Sarkozy and David Cameron. And those two individuals were able to override all the institutional safeguards that Europe is so proud about. So that decision to ruin the country and, cause a great havoc to the rest of the continent was made by very, very close, very, very narrow group of people. And there is no guarantee for Russia that the same group of people or different people with similar mentality will not make similar decisions when it comes to Russia, Ukraine, or any other country in Russia's neighborhood that will in turn destabilize this country. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Well, absolutely. And indeed, first of all, it's important to stress that Libya was not an EU action, but as you said, British and French. But in any case, you are very rightly leaving aside the historical interpretation of what happened, leaving aside the fact that, of course, we need to learn very deep lessons about how the UN functions, about how intervention is managed collectively. All of this is right. But I'm not sure I would agree with you that, therefore, as we look at the Libya story, we should obsess, including the media, by saying, oh, well, it's atavistic. You know, the West has it in its blood that they will do the same in Ukraine or wherever. I think the West, first of all, has learned its lesson with Afghanistan and Iraq and indeed Libya. I think in a way, sadly, because in Syria, I'm not sure that the West has necessarily done the right thing or any of the external interveners. But indeed, you can see in Syria that when it comes to intervening in another country, when it comes to overriding sovereignty, you know, Russia helps itself too. So it's a very widely shared problem, if it is a problem. And we all know that under certain circumstances, it may be right to intervene. That's why the international community came up with this notion of R2P, responsibility to protect. I am not saying that R2P is a reason to intervene anywhere specifically, but I'm just saying that this debate about intervention, about what you call, you know, in Russia, sovereign democracy and all of these issues is a difficult one. It's not black and white, Oksana. Yes, we should refrain from intervening and imposing our will on other countries, but in certain specific cases, then it's certain specific, very restrictive cases, we could also defend intervention.
But Professor Nikolaidis, it could be very easily argued on the Kremlin side that Libya was that specific case when Russia actually did not use its veto power, when it trusted the West, that the West was going, you know, after the good thing, but it just couldn't help itself. And, you know, the rest is history. Now, you said something before that the rest actually learned its lessons. If it indeed learned its lessons, why do you think it needs to push with the NATO expansion further and further? Wouldn't it be, you know, wiser to, you know, call a quick hold on that and allow that trust to be established within the continent and proceed from there? And who knows, maybe that trust would be enough to proceed with R2P later on. Why do you think that issue with Macedonia and keep pushing for the expansion of NATO is so present?
Earlier on, Oksana, you spoke about, well, countries should do what they want. And, you know, in terms of institution, think about it as supply and demand. NATO supplies itself and whatever service it gives, and countries demand, ask for membership or not. And wouldn't you agree that in all of these stories, we need to start from the countries themselves, even if we're talking about Ukraine or whatever countries, but in the Balkans and specifically on Macedonia today, we have countries who maybe they're wrong, you know, I don't know, but they themselves, their government and majorities of their population would like to be part of these institutions. There is this kind of attraction, whether it's the EU and the money and the markets that it represents and perhaps the values, whether it's NATO with a sense that it will bring some kind of security and like-mindedness. they demanded, they asked for it. You know, our Macedonian friends, our North Macedonian friends, the reason that they changed their own name to North Macedonia, and this is not an easy thing to do. They have a huge pushback domestically. They have extremists who are saying, no, we don't want the concession with Greece. But they think, the public opinion and the government, that the promise of NATO membership and EU membership is the right thing. They're the ones who are asking for it.
They may be asking for it, and yet it is up to the parliament to ratify that decision. And I think the whole case of Russian interference was based on allegations that supposedly that well-connected businessman was agitating against ratification. So probably if he was indeed doing that, there was some space for turning the opinion one way or another. Anyway, Professor Nikolaidis, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate the spirited discussion that you treated us to today. Thank you very much for being with us, and I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages, and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.